Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. As a citizen in a democracy, you exercise power every time you vote. But you, as a customer, also exercise power every time you shop. In fact, the decision not to buy a product is one of the most powerful weapons that a citizen can employ against the overwhelming power of governments and corporations. In today's program, we're going to look at successful American consumer boycotts, from early colonial resistance to Britain to modern-day actions, and consider why they were successful and what they achieved. So please join us for the next edition of History Counts, The Power of Not Shopping. Welcome back to History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to talk about consumer boycotts, the important role they've played in American history, the trends in boycotting today, and the possible role of boycotts in the future. To help guide us, we're very fortunate to have with us today the nation's foremost authority on consumer boycotts, Professor Monroe Friedman. Professor Friedman, who is an emeritus professor at Eastern Michigan University, has spent over 40 years researching consumer boycotts. He served as a consultant to many government offices, including the Federal Trade Commission, the National Science Foundation, and the White House Office on Consumer Affairs. He's past president of the American Council on Consumer Interests, a former editor of the Journal of Consumer Affairs, and the author of Consumer Boycotts, which was selected as an outstanding academic title of the year 2000 by the Association of College and Research Libraries. Thanks very much for being with us today, Professor Friedman.
Well, thank you for that very nice introduction.
Could you please define the term boycott for our listeners?
Well, there are many definitions, and I'll just give you one that I've used over the years, and that is an attempt by one or more parties to achieve certain objectives by urging individual consumers to refrain from making selected purchases in the marketplace.
Well, it's been said that boycotts are as American as apple pie. And indeed, in your book, you state that the boycotts occurring during the American Revolutionary period are especially important historically. Could you talk briefly about the colonial boycott against the Stamp Act in 1765?
During the American Revolution, there were boycotts of British goods in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia, following the passage of the Stamp Act. And the Stamp Act, I think, was resented, very, very much by the American settlers, because it meant that they had to purchase stamps varying in price from a few pence to a few pounds for a whole host of legal documents, mortgages, deeds, etc. And they felt it was just unfair. So in a way, this was more of a boycott on the part of not individual consumers, but merchants and retailers who were refusing to purchase British goods to sell in their shops. Because of this.
Was it successful?
Well, it was successful to the extent that Parliament repealed the Stamp Act a year later after being pressed to do so, not by Americans alone, but in this case by British merchants whose businesses had been hurt by the boycott.
The Stamp Act boycott against an entire nation was an example of what you call a surrogate boycott, like the 1933 anti-Nazi boycott by the American and World Jewish Congresses. Could you talk about the anti-Nazi boycott, too?
There was quite a different situation. Here we're going to look at what happened in the 1930s, and what happened at this particular time is that the Nazi Party came into existence in the early 30s, and just a few days later, in effect, they were calling a boycott against Jewish merchants and Jewish shops, discouraging people from shopping there by labeling the shops as such, as Jewish-owned, and encouraging people to shop in German shops that were not Jewish-owned. So what happened is that a boycott that was worldwide in scope, but the Americans and the British were the primary folks who were involved with this, but it spread to many other countries in Europe and elsewhere. Basically, what they were saying is that they were unhappy with what the Nazi Party was doing, what Hitler was doing, and they asked the world to participate by not purchasing German goods. What was so dramatic about this It's the fact that several years later, it was in actually April 28, 1939, Hitler responded to this boycott by urging President Roosevelt to do everything that he could, Franklin Delano Roosevelt at the time, as he was the president, to halt this boycott. And he wrote a letter, and I'll read you just the first couple of sentences to illustrate. And the letter was sent in response to Roosevelt's statements at the time that he felt that we should do all we can to foster more international trade, etc. And he said, "It's likewise," I'm quoting now from Hitler, "it's likewise an unbearable burden for world economic relations that it should be possible in some countries, for some ideological reason or other, to let loose a wild boycott of agitation against other countries and their goods, and so practically to eliminate them from the market. It is my belief, Mr. Roosevelt, it would be a great service if you, with your great influence, would remove these barriers genuinely to free world trade, beginning with the United States."
So it was fairly successful. You note that German-U.S. trade declined by 80% in the 1930s.
Yeah, it was fairly successful, and I'd like to think that it was successful beyond the economic side, but as we all know, that wasn't the case. And I conclude, I think that this was only a thorn rather than a spear in Hitler's side, and in light of the extraordinary devastation that resulted from the Nazi regime.
Another type of boycott, the marketplace boycott, was an extremely powerful weapon in early labor movements in the hands of the Knights of Labor and the American Federation of Labor. Could you talk about the marketplace boycott, and in particular, the AFL's We Don't Patronize list?
Well, I think it started with the Knights of Labor about 10 years before, and this was a sort of a hurly-burly group. These were immigrants at the time who were not, you know, well-educated. They really started with a boycott, and it worked quite well for them, and they used not just a primary boycott, for example, boycotting a bakery for not buying their bread that they were baking, but it extended to a secondary boycott. They would say to a food market in the same community, "Oh, you're buying bread from that bakery and selling it? Well, we're going to boycott you too." And that's a secondary boycott. So they became very powerful because they were literally boycotting everyone. Because if you're making bread or you're a dairy with milk or cheese or whatever, the whole town, whoever's selling food, would be subject to your boycott. So they went on for about 10 years or so, and then the AFL came into existence. And with the AFL, you did get this, that you just mentioned, We Don't Patronize list. And that really began, Samuel Gompers in particular, that really began the modern labor movement.
What did it mean if you were on that list?
Well, if you were on the list, basically they were saying to other members of the other labor group that you should not buy from that business.
So in the case of one of the famous boycotts, it was here in Connecticut, the Danbury Hatters boycott, it meant that any retail outlet that was selling hats made by the company that was the target would be told, please don't sell these hats.
Then they would be targeted for a boycott if they didn't comply with that.
You point out some of the advantages of this marketplace boycott in the labor movement was that it was a lot less expensive because you didn't have to have a strike fund for unemployed workers, and you could also broaden your support by enlisting a whole lot of other sympathetic unions.
And sympathetic people in general.
Right.
You're quite right. It has the effect of dramatizing issues at low cost to the union itself, as compared to a strike, where your own people would be losing income, and their families as well.
Now, the Supreme Court gave this technique a great setback in a couple important cases where some of the labor leaders were actually sentenced to prison. So the marketplace boycott diminished in labor actions, but it became extremely important as a weapon for social justice in the civil rights movement. And many people have heard about the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott involving Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. But before that, the first bus boycott was organized by Reverend Jemison in Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 1953. Could you briefly talk about that?
It became a standard, a guide to two other boycotts, one being, of course, the Martin Luther King boycott in Montgomery, and then one at around the same time, but a little bit later, in Tallahassee, Florida.
The targeting was the Jim Crow laws, which mandated segregated bus seating?
That was the target, and the boycott that occurred first in Baton Rouge, they had a much simpler situation. It was a very much shorter boycott, about a month, and they had a much more sympathetic, what should I say, constituency with which to work. He was a very, very popular minister.
You point out that one of the things that really helped him was that he organized a network of black clergymen and other organizations to get behind his new United Defense League.
He was a model for both Montgomery and Tallahassee. But he also, like Martin Luther King, was somebody who was well-educated, he was respected, he was new to his community, so he had many assets that were going for him. But unlike Martin Luther King, he had to establish his own path, and that path, as I said, became a model for Martin Luther King.
One of the things that he started that you noted was, through his nightly meetings, he organized private cars so that the blacks who were taking the buses that were being boycotted would have some way of getting to work.
Yes, and of course Martin Luther King did the same thing, as you know.
The Baton Rouge boycott was followed 2 years later by the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, involving Rosa Parks. Now, that began when she was arrested on December 1st, 1955. Can you talk about Rosa Parks?
Rosa Parks was, I think, a rather extraordinary person in many ways. She was a middle-aged, a 42-year-old seamstress by occupation, but she was also a woman who was quite respected for her values, for her views. She was, as some people may not know, active politically for about 12 years. She was secretary to the local NAACP organization in Montgomery. And as I say, somebody who was respected as being a quote-unquote a good person. In fact, there's a famous speech by Martin Luther King, which refers to her as a good person, not a good African-American or black person, but just a good person in the total community of Montgomery, blacks and whites.
There had been another incident before that where a young woman was denied a seat, and the leaders of the movement in Montgomery, Joanne Robinson and Edie Nixon, had decided she wasn't the right person to represent the movement in a challenge to the segregation law.
Well, that's true, and the reasons, I think, were twofold. First, she was quite young. She was about just 15 years old, and it turned out she was pregnant. They sort of assumed that whoever this person would be subjected to very, very close scrutiny by the local white community. And they wanted to make sure this was somebody who was just, you know, unparalleled with regard to respect and dignity. And somehow a young girl of that age and with her condition, that just didn't feel would be the appropriate person to base this whole movement on in the city.
Now, she was arrested, Rosa Parks was arrested on December the 1st, which was a Thursday, and
yes.
They called the boycott for December the 5th, the very next Monday. How did they manage to pull it off in such a short time?
Joanne Robinson was a professor at a local a black university in Montgomery, and she had been part of a women's council and had been advising the government on how they should be doing more for local African-Americans. When this happened, she felt that they really should call a boycott. She was a professor, so she went back to her university with a couple of her trusted students and wrote out a request for local blacks to participate in a boycott, and they literally ran off thousands, tens of thousands of this request. And then they attempted, so this was Thursday night, they did all this all night, and then Friday they were distributed to the black community, and I think they had hoped this would be a surprise on Monday morning, but there was a maid who worked for a white family, and she was concerned and thought that maybe they should know about this, so she took this little circular to the house when she went to work the next day, and they in turn announced this to the newspaper, and there was an article appearing on Saturday and Sunday, and first they were concerned about this, that this would somehow make the boycott ineffective. But once Monday came around and they found that the buses were just virtually empty, not just of blacks, but of whites as well, I think some of the whites might have been concerned there would be trouble, and they figured, well, maybe we'll stay home or hitch a ride with a friend or whatever. That's really what happened in those 4 days. The first was Thursday, and then the second Friday, and then the weekend, and then Monday was the actual the first day of the boycott.
How did Martin Luther King become involved in the Montgomery bus boycott?
Monday morning, it became apparent that the boycott was a success, and it became apparent to everyone. So now the question is, how do we continue this? They knew that someone had to be in charge of this effort. So they looked around and they said, well, you know, and this is similar again to what happened in Louisiana, Baton Rouge. Here's a guy, Martin Luther King, who's new to our community, 26 years old, just completed a doctorate at Boston University. So this is a man who's educated, and we've heard that he has a gift for oratory. I don't think they had actually experienced it themselves, but that's what they had heard. They decided, a small group, E.D. Nixon and Joan Robinson, perhaps some others, he should be the person to lead the boycott. So they made this invitation. He thought it over and decided he would do it. So that's how he got involved.
Like the Baton Rouge boycott, it was very much church-based, was it not? And then other groups came in?
Remember, these ministers in the South were very respected people, and sometimes among African-Americans, some of the few that really had extensive education. They had these things going for them, so it wasn't surprising that when it came to a what they saw, I think, as a moral issue, that they would come to the forefront and become...
So we see the NAACP, the United Auto Workers, peace groups coming in to support this Montgomery boycott. So they actually were able to raise funds to create, you say, an extensive alternative transportation system.
Well, they did that. Of course, the Baton Rouge people did, but it was a much shorter time. It was only about a month, that whole boycott. So, and then, of course, it became publicized all over the country, and they got funds and gifts of various sorts. Not just in Montgomery or in Alabama, but throughout the United States.
How long was the Montgomery bus boycott sustained?
Well, it started, I guess, on December 5th, and then a year later, so a little over a year, I think it was December 20th. But, you know, we have to go beyond what happened in Montgomery to look at the role of the NAACP, if I could take a moment to do that.
Sure.
Because this really was an issue that was settled in the courts, you know, in a very strict sense. And the people who were at the forefront of it for the African-American community was the NAACP. I mean, they're located in Baltimore, just down the road from Washington. And it was the attorneys that were in the forefront here for the NAACP, you know, trying to fight for desegregation of the buses. And the person in particular who was in the forefront was Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice. And I think there was also a little bit of a competition between these people who saw themselves as very savvy. They had devoted their lives to these kinds of defense efforts. And I think they might have been a little skeptical of these young ministers who thought that they knew what they were doing and they could, you know, call a boycott and bring it off because they knew it had to be settled in the courts. They went forward with their protest and they won, first in Montgomery area. And then it went to the Supreme Court for approval, and they did approve it. And then a month later, all the paperwork was ready, and it became a reality. December 10th of the following year, and at that date, the boycott ended because there was no need for it, because now it was the law of the land.
Now, there's been a trend in recent years away from these marketplace boycotts towards media-oriented boycotts, ecological boycotts. Could you talk about the 1988 boycott against Benetton to prevent the testing of cosmetics on animals?
The organization that was in the forefront is called PETA, P-E-T-A, which stands for People for Ethical Treatment of Animals. And they're a nationwide organization, and they were quite concerned about the fact that animals were being used as the test objects, you might say, for these cosmetics. So what they did is that they decided to have a boycott campaign.
Why did they pick Benetton?
They looked for a company that they thought would be vulnerable. And one of the reasons they thought Benetton would be vulnerable is that they had just gone from clothing, which was their mainstay, to cosmetics. And they thought if they were new to this area of commerce, that they would be more likely to change than somebody who had been entrenched in this for maybe decades. This was one reason. The other reason is that Benetton has stores. both at that time in the U.S. and in Europe. And they felt that because of these stores, there was a possibility of picketing stores, where many of the other cosmetics are just in, they're in drugstores, but they're not in stores with their own name. Of course, is that PETA had groups that had sympathies with PETA's objectives in Europe, where Benetton had stores too. So I think for those three reasons, the fact that Benetton was new and maybe more flexible about changing, the fact that they had stores which could be the focus for pickets, and the fact that they had or PETA had operations similar to itself in Europe, and therefore they could be called upon. And I think they were right. I had an opportunity to interview the president of Benetton in doing my research, and he said they were just blown away. They had all kinds of controversial advertising campaigns, and they prided themselves in being the people on the edge rather than the people in the middle. And they thought the idea of somebody calling a boycott against them, especially a group which also thought of themselves as being on the cutting edge rather than an establishment group. So he was just sort of dumbfounded at first when this happened.
So Benetton conceded?
They did concede. In fact, what happened, they not only conceded, but they became champions of the movement. They gave money to PETA. One of the PETA PR pieces, the president of Benetton is even featured as a pro-PETA person.
And how about the other big companies in the cosmetics industry? Did they follow?
Some of them did. Quite a few of them did. I think the most resistance came from those that were overseas. I think L'Oreal is one that comes to mind. But if you're an American company and this is all happening in America, I think it's kind of tough to look the other way. And on the other hand, if you're, based elsewhere, you have a little more distance from it, both geographically, I think, and maybe also politically. You're not as ready, perhaps, to concede, right away.
In these media-oriented boycotts, staged news events become very important. Could you talk about the media event staged by the Rainforest Action Network at the San Francisco headquarters of the Mitsubishi Bank of California in 1995?
Not only did I interview people from PETA, I spent a couple of days there, but I also interviewed people from, they call it RAN, or Rainforest Action Network. In fact, I spoke with a young woman in her maybe mid-20s, and we talked a bit, and I said, well, do you use conventional boycott-type things? And she said, oh, no, she said, they don't work, meaning the marketplace boycott. Should we learn that right away? There's just too much money out there, and buying advertising, and we just can't get through the consumers. So we have to come up with dramatic news events. And I'll give you an example of what I did just a few weeks ago. She and, I guess, a colleague from RAN, also a young woman, they went to this building, and they found a way, I don't know how, and she didn't disclose to me how, to get up to the top of the building. And then they had, they had done exercise over a period of a month or so to toughen their bodies, and they let themselves down from the top of the building on the side with ropes, and they unfurled a banner between the two of them, and there were two words on the banner, boycott Mitsubishi. Now, at the time they did that, or maybe a few hours before, they let all the news media outlets in San Francisco area know what they were doing, when they were doing, etc. And their objective was to get on the evening news. And they felt if they could be part of a news event, rather than advertising, that this would give them more legitimacy. And so this is why they did it. But that's the sort of thing. They also indicated to me that they were going to auto showrooms for these national or regional auto fairs that they have each year. And the kind of thing they wanted to do is to take handcuffs and handcuff themselves to, the cars that are there that are open for people to inspect, with the idea that somebody would call the police to arrest them. And they wanted nothing more than them. That would be perfect for them. They wanted, then somebody else would call the news media to cover that. They wanted to get in the news, and they felt that was what kind of thing they had to do, dramatic events. So that's the idea of a media boycott.
We say there's a big difference between calling for a boycott and actually pulling one off. What makes a boycott work?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a big difference between boycott and the calling for a boycott. And much of what you hear nowadays, and that I hear, because I get calls from the news media when boycotts occur, and the question they ask me is this boycott going to work? And I mentioned, I said, what boycott? They said, well, didn't you hear a boycott was called today by this prominent political figure? And I say, is it a boycott or is it a call for a boycott? And almost invariably, it's a call for a boycott. In other words, the next day, nothing happens. There's no organization that's there. There's no money that's there. There's no savvy to make sure that the news media gets more and more stories to keep the thing going. In other words, you need something like a political campaign. You need stories day after day after day to remind people of this issue so they won't forget it.
Organization is important.
Organization is critically important, and not just organization, but having really savvy people and, of course, having money to sustain this kind of thing. And that's where, if you have an organization like PETA or like NAACP that's existing, you can take a boycott and it can be run by that organization without having to start from scratch and establish a new organization. And most people don't have the funds to do that. So that's why I think you find organizations like NAACP and PETA and RAND continuing with boycott kinds of activities.
What do you see as the future of boycotting, especially in light of the advent of the Internet?
Well, I think the fact that we now have, you know, computer networks and the fact that they're international, I think has really changed things a lot. I think it's possible for a boycott group, for example, to get a website, establish a website, and that can be the coordination or communication vehicle. And this can also go beyond our borders. It can be international. So you have the possibility of, with websites and with computers in general and the Internet in general, to do much more than was possible before and to do it much more internationally than it was possible before.
Professor Friedman, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. We've been speaking with Professor Monroe Friedman about the history and nature of consumer boycotts, and I'll be right back. One of the most successful modern consumer boycotts was initiated in the late 1960s by Cesar Chavez, leader of the United Farm Workers Union. Since farm laborers were migrants who worked seasonally and moved from farm to farm, they were difficult for the union to recruit and easy for employers to replace. So Chavez worked the problem from the other end. He organized a consumer boycott of grapes by shoppers who sympathized at the plight of underpaid farm workers. Why grapes? First, grapes are a discretionary purchase. Shoppers could easily pick an alternate fruit. Second, the sales of grapes were concentrated at supermarkets in just 10 major cities, so the union could focus its efforts. Third, the nonviolence of the boycott approach invoked the spirit of Gandhi and gave the union the high moral ground. Soon, institutions like the AFL-CIO and the United Auto Workers, as well as church and student groups, got behind the boycott. As shoppers exercised their power of not shopping, grape shipments to New York City dropped by 30% in 6 months. With this success behind them, the United Farm Workers compelled growers to sign a collective bargaining agreement in 1970. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.